So I want to just talk briefly, or we'll see how brief it is, on this passage from Hebrews. Last week we skipped over the reading from Hebrews, but there's this huge chunk in the middle of Hebrews, beginning in chapter 5, that treats this idea that Jesus as high priest is superior to the previous regulations and commandments that God gave to Moses for the worship of God. And this is a unique contribution of the writer to the Hebrews in the New Testament, this idea of Christ's work and role as high priest. And we'll be singing a hymn in our offertory that talks about Christ both as victim and priest. So there's this, you know, it's sort of fun. Postmodernists would have loved it back in the day. They should love it now. It's this subversion of the constructs of the concepts. So there's this central piece. It's the main point of the sermon. Hebrews reads like a sermon, so I'm going to refer to him as the preacher. The preacher is developing this theme, substantially developing in the center of his sermon, about Jesus and his superiority as the high priest. And he's writing in particular because he's writing to a Jewish audience, and there was some temptation for the Jewish people under persecution to return to their previous Jewish understanding of worshiping God and to leave that understanding that had been revealed through Jesus, and that the early church, the Christians, the followers of Christ, that is Jesus of Nazareth, these followers of Christ said, here's this new and great way that's been opened up, access to God, freedom to come as his children, and all of this is through the ministry and the work and the teaching of Jesus. And so the writer to the Hebrews is giving encouragement, support, and reason, logic to help these people stay the course as followers of Jesus. And as I mentioned, I think when we first got into Hebrews in our lectionary, Hebrews is a great book for the religious people, for those raised in the church. I'm not aware of anybody being raised in Judaism, but there's religions across the world have similar contours, similar things that they're about, similar things. And so those of us who grew up religious, we will find in the book of Hebrews some relevancy that we don't get in Paul or the other writings. That was at least my experience, and it still seems true. So that we too can hear a word today about the sufficiency of Christ vis-a-vis, or in the context, or in contrast to religious approaches to life and religious approaches to God. And the way the writer or the preacher talks about this, the preacher of Hebrews says that this is in the context of our conscience. All of these things that existed previously could never fully answer the challenge and the threat of the guilty conscience, the witness and testimony. In fact, says the writer to the Hebrews, the preacher, when you look at the whole system, and that's part of what he's contrasting here. So God talks to Moses. He says, here's this plan. You need to make a temple. It was a portable temple. It's called the tabernacle. This is when they're in the desert, when God is beginning this relationship with the people of Israel, formal covenant relationship. I will be a God to you. You will be my people. I'll dwell among you. Well, says God, for me to dwell among you, I need a place. And here's the way it needs to be built. It's after this copy of the heavenly temple. That's the part of what the preacher of Hebrews is asking us to understand in this. But at any rate, God tells Moses how to build this tabernacle. And the very nature of the tabernacle and all of the associated rituals and sacrifices is both God in us and among us and in our presence, so that we can see God and we can enter his place, and also a reminder, as the writer to the Hebrews says, the way to God is not yet open, because there was a court. Inside the court there was this It was essentially a little building. It was movable because these were nomadic people. But it wasn't like just a tent. They had big beams and they would construct this tabernacle. The first half of that had all the things that the priests would do daily, lighting candles, incense, and this sort of stuff to worship God. And then there was this big curtain. And the second part of that holy temple where God would himself dwell among his people was only entered once a year by the high priest. And the high priest would first offer a sacrifice for himself in his own sins and the sins of his family. And then he would offer a sacrifice for the sins of the people. And he would take the blood of these sacrifices inside the veil once a year only and perform prescribed activities inside that Holy of Holies and then leave, hopefully, because occasionally, or at least the possibility was that the high priest would die having entered the presence of God improperly. And so the writer to the Hebrews says, or the preacher says, listen, folks, this whole thing is about demonstrating that the way is not open. Yes and no. So there's God, and the very nature of everything that he has put in place reminds us that the way is not open. And God, in his condescension, his loving care as a parent, his faithful care as a covenant partner, says, here's a way to take the edge off the accidental sins, the sins of ignorance. There was no sin for willful sin in the Old Testament, deliberate, intentional, planned sin. You were already off the chart on that one. This is for the guilty conscience that says, I didn't live up, as we pray in our confession, the things we left undone. Right? Well, I didn't live up to the light of my own convictions and my own best intentions. And so says the writer to the Hebrews, and I can read this for us. It's in verse 9. We didn't read verse 9. Well, we read the first part of verse 9. But he says, this is a symbol of the present time, meaning this whole idea that only once a year could the holiest of holies be entered. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience. We can't answer the guilty conscience, and this is the motivation of all religious behavior. So there's a whole class of people for whom the conscience does not trouble them, for whatever reasons. They're not part of the conversation. Conversation is about the person who knows that something's not quite right, that they haven't lived the way they should, or whatever the case may be. They're aware of some failing. Maybe that's a continual daily failing. Maybe that's something that happened 25, 30, 40 years ago. Religious humans are in that range of both living continually with failings or still trying to pay for one biggie, the skeletons in the closet. And the religion says, here's a hopeful thing for you to do. Do these things, and it's possible that God will be okay with you. And yet, having done them with the promise, there's still this reminder of the doubt, at least, or the active accusation of conscience. And so the whole thing is a self-reinforcing cycle, right? I hope and I'm willing and I'm invested and oh yeah, it was great. We had a good worship time. We had this and that and the other thing and the sacrifices were offered and I walk away and that doubt begins to creep back in. So I'm motivated to come back and do it all over again. So this is a mechanism that drives all religious behavior. True for the Jewish people, inscribed by God, in fact, says the preacher, written right into the conditions. These things are never going to touch the inside, which is where the real need is. At best, they can clean the outside. They can clean the flesh, the body. But as the prophets begin to tell us sometime later in Israel's history, the problem is with the heart, and God's promised a new heart. And so, says the writer to the Hebrews, And we can apply that for us today. Resist the temptation of religion because it's just a cycle that never delivers what it promises. But by the very nature that it seems possible, we get hooked and invested and we become more and more deliberate, more and more anxious, more and more religious, you might say. And we think that's a progress, but it's not progress, according to the writer to the Hebrews or according to the preacher. Instead, he says, here's what's happened in Jesus, and this is verse 13 and 14. If the blood of goats and bulls and ashes of heifers, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, for the outside cleansing, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, how much more will the blood of Christ cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Now, here's the dilemma. Jesus says it clearly, and perhaps the church isn't faithful in reminding us of this, because it's sort of shooting ourselves in the foot. Religion serves the church well, right? Getting you addicted to trying to really hard to cleanse your own conscience means you're coming back every Sunday and you're, et cetera, et cetera. This freedom of the Spirit and truly being clean is more risky. But here's the dilemma. Jesus says, only those drawn by the Father can come to me. And Jesus says this in response to a time, this is in John chapter 6, at the end of chapter 6 in John's Gospel. Jesus has said some hard teachings and many of his disciples left and did not follow him any longer. And Jesus does not chase after these people. He says, this is why I said, you cannot come to me unless the Father draws you. So here's the dilemma. You and I hear this good word about Jesus, and you and I say to ourselves, yes, my conscience still troubles me. I don't know what the problem is. My psychologist thinks I need, or whatever. Like there's various ways we can treat this. But finally, if it's an irreducible sort of knowledge, a witness that we bear to ourselves, things just aren't right yet. For whatever reasons, however you want to fill in the blanks for why they're not right. And I come to Jesus, I say, I'd just love to be cleansed. I have my conscience cleansed for eternity, once for all time, this promise. But I can't make myself believe that, and I can't talk myself into believing that, because when I do that, I'm becoming religious again. Do you understand that? I cannot say I'm going to believe this because now I'm become religious again, trying to work my way into some truth that's currently not eluding me. How do I know I'm in the truth? Because my spirit, as Paul says elsewhere twice, the Spirit himself bears witness to us by which that we're the children of God, by which we cry out, Abba, Father. That's the thing that the writer to the Hebrews says has happened, and it happened to you, and you need to treasure that and safeguard that. Why would you return to something that's inadequate, some sort of religious behavior that never actually answers the need? Why would you not hold fast to this thing that has answered the cry of your heart? But there's some of us for whom that is not yet true, and I don't have any answer except for the answer of Jesus. And that is that the Father will draw those he's calling to himself. And so I guess if you want to say, well, what should I do, preacher? I would say, don't motivate yourself religiously to try and do something that only God can do. Confess that to God and confess to him that you're willing to wait for him and his timing. Now, this all pertains as, let me finish the thought of the writer or the preacher here in this section we read. So Jesus does this thing that the religious behaviors could never do, that is answer the witness and testimony of the conscience, the guilty conscience. He can satisfy that. And he does this not by offering himself continually, because then he would have needed to die all the time. He does this in a way that religion can't answer, because that needs to be repeated. But Jesus once died for sins. And then he says, Just like with humans, because Jesus was human, he couldn't die more than once, because this is the truth for humans. They live, they die, then there's judgment. In the same way, says the preacher, Jesus, who offered himself for sins, died once, and he will return again without sin, and that is having nullified sin, for those who eagerly await his coming. And there's this beautiful picture here. Now, last week I mentioned death because that is the great clarion call, the great trumpet call of Christianity, that humans have been freed from the fear of slavery, the fear of death, which led to slavery their whole lives. That was Hebrews chapter 2. And Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15 that the sting of death is sin. So why is death fearful? Because of sin and what gives sin power? The law. And that's this whole troubled conscience, the whole witness we have that we have not lived according to our best lights, let alone the best lights that God has revealed. And here the writer to the Hebrews says, we need fear no longer, because for the Christian who has already accepted judgment, when they die, they await the coming of Jesus, who himself has met the cry and the claim and the demand for judgment, so that we will meet him and sin will be nullified, made void. And in that encounter, you know, our eager anticipation of his return will be answered. And this is this like, how do you even say words? If this actually hits your spirit in your heart, and you're just like, if I can't fear death, what could I fear? Like, your spirit just soars. Your heart just leaps with joy. In Christ, I am more than conquerors, because he has conquered all. What has he conquered? He's conquered death. What's the thing that's the greatest limit in your life? Your own death. And when you think about your loved ones, what's the thing that's the greatest limit? It's their death, whether they're dead already, or one can anticipate that in anxiety and fear. When we hear this word of freedom in Christ, and our own conscience ceases to bear witness against us, then we feel the release of all threats, death being that representation of the greatest threat. And so on a day in which we gather and we remember the dead, our dead, the ones we carry in our hearts, and we remember the dead of those who offered their life and sacrifice for their country, we acknowledge that there is one who holds the keys of death now, and it's not Satan any longer, and it's not the enemy. It's our Father in his love and mercy, and he calls us to live today on the other side of those limitations, to live with a freedom and a dignity, the wholeness of being recreated, the dignity of being the children of God, a freedom that lays aside all that would naggingly hinder and limit and nip away at us. And it's a glorious, glorious vision. And the preacher says, why would you return to your religious past, to religious behaviors, when you can live here, free in the love of God and the Spirit of Christ? And the church has always said, and this is a great mystery, the Bible, we can't say much about it because the Bible doesn't teach much about it. But the church has always said that this promise and hope that we now carry is one that we can share with others, including our dead. So all of us have lost loved ones. That might just be fairly distant, a generation or two removed. Maybe you've lost loved ones that are more immediate, more integrated into your life. And we're invited today to release them as well. into this great hope we have now in the one who stands beyond death, the one whose return we welcome and await eagerly, and committing them and ourselves to the grace and mercy of God to live with a freedom that the world can only admire but never understand, that we ourselves can only rejoice in, not harness and not use, but to experience and enjoy as we return our thanks and praise to the one who loves us, gave himself for us, and now sits enthroned above all authority, all power, all things present, past, or future, including death. To him be the glory.